The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's show...
What's not to love about concrete?
I don't know.
50% of everything that's made is made of concrete. So in a way, we all love concrete. We just don't realise it yet.
Yes, stuff really matters to engineer and broadcaster Mark Miodovnik. Mark's here to regale us with tales from the world of materials science and how materials have had a hand in creating ancient and contemporary societies. And
what we find is that 35% of women globally will experience partner violence or sexual violence from someone other than their partner.
The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley, meets the authors of a World Health Organization report that reveals, for the first time, the economic and public health burdens on countries caused by domestic violence against women. Also, we'll be taking a look at some of this week's science news, including wind farms, GM crops, and why we should all be looking up to the sky on July the 19th. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. If Mark Miodovnik was a material, you'd find that he was one with multiple remarkable properties. He's a noted and active engineer and material scientist with an academic position as Professor of Materials and Society at the University College London. He's also a regular presenter on science and engineering programmes on the BBC, and his latest book, Stuff Matters, is his love letter to the materials that make up our world. He's here to tell me more. Mark, welcome to the programme. You think that materials are underloved, don't you?
I do.
Why do you think that?
Well, you ask anyone, you know, about materials, and they kind of don't know what to say. You know, they'll love gold or diamonds, and if they happen to be redoing their bathroom, they might love some very expensive terracotta tile from Italy. But after that, it kind of goes out of their head because it's all around us all the time. We clothe ourselves with it. Houses are made of it. You know, everything is made of something, and that stuff is materials. And I think partly it's because if people really did think about it, they'd spend the whole time just wandering around, marvelling at what we've done, what we've created, and they wouldn't get anything else done.
Which is basically what you do now. It's not even a joke. Your book starts with a quite harrowing tale, actually, of young Mark, the schoolboy, going onto the tube after being stabbed. And this ignited your passion for materials. But is that a normal reaction for people who get stabbed?
I don't know if it's a normal reaction, but I do.
Tell us what happened.
Trauma, yeah. Well, I was on Hammersmith Station. I was a school kid, 16, and this guy came up to me and said, "Oh, give me your wallet." And he was kind of very aggressive, very sure. And there were loads of people on the station, and I was amazed that no one else kind of said anything. But actually, I was just too polite to say help or what or anything.
So I didn't want to cause a fuss.
So. I looked, and he didn't show me his knife. He just had his pocket, and he had a pointy thing coming through his pocket, you know, bulging. And I was like, well, I bet it's not, you know, typical academic. I was like, yeah, right, probably isn't a knife. So the train came in at that point. I made a split-second decision just to push past him and get on the train. I thought he'd just leave me alone. And he just ran up behind me and just slashed my back. And I remember the moment very clearly because it's not as painful as you think, but it is. The first thing was I was really irritated. So I was like, oh, I got that wrong. And then as I sat down, I thought, God, this feels like the worst paper cut I've ever had. He must have actually, you know, cut me a little bit, but it can't be too bad. So I just went home. And as I got off the seat, I looked behind me and the seat was just bright red.
Oh, God.
And I thought, crikey, uh-oh. And I went home and...
You're so English, crikey. I've lost a lot of blood, crikey. But this the point of the story is not to sort of dwell upon your trauma, which sounds awful, but is to say that this particular wound was caused by stainless steel. And yeah. It's a lovely story. So what is it about stainless steel that started to really intrigue you then?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of knife crime around and people, people worry about, let's say, gun crime and they worry about access to guns. But the thing is, everyone has access to the best knife you're ever going to get. And it's a razor for shaving. And it is so unbelievably sharp. And have you ever thought the fact that you don't really need to, you know, you don't have to sharpen it? And that's because it's made of stuff that doesn't rust. And although it does get blunt over time because of its interactions with hair, it is this wonder of sharpness and convenience, and it's in everyone's bathroom, there it is, and yet it's completely ignored. And if you take that little sliver of metal back in time 100 years, people wouldn't believe it was even possible to have stainless steel. They wouldn't even believe it.
So tell me what stainless steel is and the, why it is so special, given that, you know, we're very familiar with this stuff. I mean, we and now knives and forks, paper clips, everything is made of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so steel obviously was a big deal, and people, you know, throughout history, and people, you know, got the hang of it, and it was, you know, it's the best material for tools and for sharp things. But no one believed it could be stainless. It, that was his big defect. It had to be rusted, it had to be sharpened, all these things. And the idea that you can make something stainless, well, how do you do that? How do you even think about what rust is and why it happens? And it turns out to be this interaction with oxygen and water with the metal. And obviously gold and silver don't suffer from it so much. So why is it that iron does? And then you think, well, how can we solve it? Well, let's put a coating on it. So that's what you do with bridges, and go around and you see all these iron and steel bridges, and they all got painted, and all the cars that everyone drives around are all painted to stop this process happening. But what if you could create a coating that was invisible, transparent, let's say, and was really thin? Well, that would stop it rusting, and that's exactly what stainless steel is. But the coat is generated by the material itself. So you put in chromium and some nickel, and it creates this invisible coating on the outside. You can't see it, but it stops it rusting. And not just that. What's really special is that if you scratch it, or it, a bit of that comes off, the material reforms the coating itself. So it's self-healing.
Wait, this sounds way more complex than I would have thought. How does someone come up with this? It's not something that someone theoretically comes up with. I mean, where did it come from as an idea?
So it was discovered by accident by a guy called Harry Brearsley in Sheffield. And actually, it's the 100th anniversary of the discovery of stainless steel. And I think there's two things to note here. One is, lots and lots of materials and other bits of technology are discovered by accident, and that is the wonderful thing about engineering and science. That accidents and experimenting and not knowing what you're doing is actually a healthy thing to do if you want to make a great discovery. And that's exactly what he was doing. He was alloying steel to make hard gun barrels for the World War I, and he failed. And he, you know, but he was just experimenting, and he found that he added chromium, and it didn't work, and he threw the sample into the corner. And a month later, he came back, and all the other samples and all the other experiments were all rusted, you know, that kind of rusty look, and one wasn't. One was still bright. And instead of walking away and thinking, oh, gosh, I can't be bothered to think about that, he thought, hold on a minute, that's really special. So I guess discoveries and discoverers, they have to be experimenters, but they also have to be people who recognize something unusual when they see it.
Now, the ages of human civilization are all named after various materials, so the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, Iron Age. And in a sense, they represent the chemical sophistication of our society, what we can get out of the ground. All these things have been in the ground and always, and these labels are simply how able we are to get them out. So can you just take me through the various ages and what it is that they did in terms of making civilization, human civilization, happen?
Well, let's start with the Stone Age. So imagine you're on the planet, you're an evolved ape. You've got, aspirations. What are you going to do? You want to make some clothes. You want to make some things to make your life a bit better. You want to make fire and pots and pans and start cooking. Well, you've only got stone. So you start finding these slivers of stone, flints. And actually, when they look back at the historical record, they find that they were very sophisticated, not just making flints, so into cutting devices, so you could cut up hide to make clothes and furs, but you could also make it to cut up food and meat and therefore to cook it. And they were extremely good at this. And in fact, they even did material selection, so they even found the best materials for the sharpest edge. But you can't go any further than that, because every time you use one of these flints, it basically breaks, so you have to make another one. And the ideal material for a tool is one where you're using it, and if it's sort of dents or, you know, gets a bit blunt, you can resharpen it, but you can't do that with these flints. So if you've ever tried to make anything at all without a knife, let's say, or without some metal tools, basically like a saw, try and cut down a tree with a flint really hard, even an axe, a stone axe, extremely difficult. So you need a saw, you need a cutting edge, and you need all these kind of tools. And metal is the perfect thing to do. Now, there was metal around. It's called native metals, and it's either gold, which is very, very, very rare and very soft.
Not very good for cutting trees down either.
No, and you couldn't find enough of it anyway. There's a bit of copper and there's a bit of iron. It's basically come from meteors that have hit the Earth. So some people must have found this, and they maybe were using it, but there was too little of it to really be useful. At some point, at some point our ancestors struck upon this moment where the rock, so there's a rock called malachite, it's a green rock. It was, if you put it in a fire in the right conditions and you get it hot enough, it will decompose into copper. Now that moment, God, that moment is probably the most important moment in the history of our
another accident, probably.
Probably another accident, yeah. And then they realised, God, that rock all around us, that is full of metal and we can get it out. And once they had copper, they could make tools. And then you can do all sorts of, you can cut down trees, you can make boats, you can make houses, you can make shelter, you can make sophisticated clothes, you can have sewing needles. You're off as a civilization. And then, of course, what you're trying to do is get harder and harder metals or tougher and tougher metals. So the copper, I mean, the pyramids were built with copper chisels, but they would have blunted very quickly. So they estimate that after three or four knocks onto a bit of stone, you'd have to resharpen that chisel. Now, you can't build the pyramids without metal. You just can't do it.
Yeah, there's none in them, but you need the tools to do it.
Yeah, so architecture as a complete whole is due to metals. and the desire for sharper, stronger, more useful metals is the desire to understand them, but they had no way of doing it. So they experimented, and they happened across first bronze, which is an alloy with copper and tin and some arsenic, and then they found this other one, which was iron, which was much more plentiful. Because the problem with copper and bronze was that although it was quite a good material, it was quite rare to find these outcrops, and it was traded all around the place. But if you were in, let's say, the north of England and you wanted some copper, well, tough luck, you have to go to Cornwall, and that's a long way in those days. So, but actually there's some rocks in the north of England which are full of iron, so let's get the iron out of them. But iron alloys are much more complicated, and they didn't realise that the alloying element in iron is the actual stuff of the fire itself, carbon. So it was really hard to control it, and they basically failed. But some people managed to, and those people were very, very special people. Probably the origins of alchemists, and these were the swordsmiths, these were the blacksmiths. The blacksmith was the most useful person you could ever have.
Oh, let's, yeah. Let's move on from metals, plastics. Now, metals are sort of plastic in themselves, in a small P way, in their stretch, and they you can change their shape. But plastics themselves, polymers, they're a different thing altogether. Tell us a little bit about what makes them special.
You can't really have civilization without metals. You can definitely have it without plastics. We did for a long time. But you can't have a modern life without plastics. That's the thing. That plastics embody a modernity. It's about comfort. It's about the fact that as I walk down the road in my trainers, I'm bouncing down the road and then springing my step because the plastic on the bottom of my trainer is springy. And actually, it's called an elastomer, so rubber is an elastomer. And before rubber comes along, we get wet a lot. We don't have a waterproof substance that we can coat things with. We don't have tyres, so things like any kind of vehicle is very, very, very bumpy. So you see what I mean? This is a material of comfort. This is a material that molds itself around the human body to the human. Your skin is a plastic, essentially, right? There's lots of polymers in your skin, which is what your cells are made of. And so this is a material that's much more like being human. It's much more like the comfort of yourself. And we've cocooned ourselves in our houses with this stuff because that's what we like to feel. We don't like to see you don't have a metal wall. And some people do live with a brick wall or a concrete wall, but actually they like to actually sit on a sofa. When you're sitting on a sofa, you're sitting on plastic because what's comfortable about a sofa is the foam, and that's made of a polymer, so it's a plastic.
And so this is actually also a result of the sort of industrialization of the world as well. When you dig up oil to burn in your power plants and in steam engines and all sorts of other things, you also can produce polymers from this stuff. This is where plastics come from.
Yeah, and this is the big thing. Obviously, rubber starts off coming out, and still does today, actually, from a tree in the form of latex. And it's a sort of, it's a great story how, people see this white stuff coming out of a tree and turn it into this modern material. But to satisfy a democratic urge that everybody should be able to live with the degree of luxury that people do now, so that everybody should be able to have a pair of trainers and everybody should have a nylon tracksuit. Then you've got to have then you've got to have an industrial supply of the material to make that stuff, and that's oil. I mean, it is ludicrous that we burn oil. It is mad because it is the perfect, like, it's like we've inherited from the earth this enormous fund of raw material to make plastics from. And what are we doing? We're burning it. It's essentially being given a massive house by your grandmother and grandfather and then just burning the furniture. That's exactly what we're doing with oil. It's just bonkers.
It does provide energy for electricity and things, though.
But we can get that from other things.
We can get that from elsewhere.
We don't need to do that. We don't need to burn the stuff that you know, that really you can make wondrous things from.
Yeah. Plastics is kind of the sort of, as you said, the element of modernity, but nothing is more modern than silicon. And this is not maybe something you see every day, but we're all aware that everything runs essentially because of silicon chips.
Yeah. So silicon definitely is one of the pivotal materials that was invented in the 20th century. And of course, people knew about silicon before, but no one had taken it and made it into something that could compute. And that's the thing. There are no moving parts inside a silicon chip. And yet this thing is computing information. And in fact, every time you use your mobile phone or your computer, and in fact, yeah, the information coming down this microphone now, it's all being accrued by these little bits of silicon crystal itself and sent one way or the other, depending on whether it's a one or a zero. And that is that it's the end of the clockwork. It's the end of the mechanical era. We're into solid state computation. And it's material being intelligent. It's material being so well understood at the nanoscale and at the microscale that you can use it to, you know, replace all these cogs and wheels.
Well, what's fascinating about silicon, I suppose, is that until when you say the word material, normally you think of something structural, something covering something else. It's a stuff that you can touch, and you can touch silicon, of course, and silicon chips. But that's not what's special about it. It's not the structural element or what it looks like. It is, as you say, it's the intelligence that's in there, which is quite intriguing. And that's only going to grow. I mean, silicon obviously was the first chips were made completely of silicon and the transistors and stuff. But since then, you've had other rare earth metals and other things doing rather special things, which are intelligent in a way. And it's going to continue. We talk about things like graphene on this podcast quite a lot. And this is the material of the future. I mean, graphene has had so much said about it. Yeah, it's something still quite new, really, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, it's very new, yeah. And I think graphene is another good example of a material not discovered by accident, because they knew what they were trying to get, but they had no idea how good it was until they actually, you know, managed to get a piece of it and have a go of measuring its properties.
And just to say, graphene is a sort of single layer sheet of graphite, so essentially chicken wire arrangement of carbon atoms, one dimensional.
Yes, so
two dimensional. Sorry, it's one dimensional.
It's a two dimensional material, and a lot of it's. I mean, a lot of the hype around graphene is to do with the fact that it's, you know, the stiffest, best conductor, strongest material around. And it's very lightweight. But I think carbon in general, if you look at these carbon structures, what you're saying, this hexagonal sheet material, if you roll it up, you have a nanotube, carbon nanotube, and they're also hugely important materials. And then if you kind of wrap it into a ball, you have a buckyball. I think carbon, because of its very great strength and its amazing electrical and mechanical properties, and its lightweightness, is going to be a big mechanical workhorse for the future. I think steel has taken us so far, but I'd be very surprised in 20 years' time if cars are made of steel. I think they'll be made of carbon.
Well, they kind of are sometimes now, aren't they? Carbon fiber, for example, but they're very expensive.
They're the Formula One, yeah, but that's the top end, and it will go down. And it makes total sense. Like, why would you drive around in something that's very heavy when you can drive around something that's much lighter and stiffer? So carbon fiber technology is going to grow, and it's going to get into buildings, it's going to get into cars, it's already in airplanes. And so I think it's hugely exciting. And because of this combination of mechanical and electrical properties, you could also have this kind of intelligence in a structure the size of a building. And that's what I like the idea of, which is that you're used to bodies and trees. Let's say trees have these little roots through them which take the sap, and they bring back the chemicals and the, you know, all of the sugars, and so they transport things inside them as well as being structural entities. And buildings of the future, I think, are going to go that way. And I think carbon is a good contender for being able to do that kind of thing.
It seems as though the history of the materials then that we've talked about so far, it's about understanding more and more what these things are doing at the molecular scale, manipulating that in future. We're talking about nanotechnology and other things like that, where you can actually start to manipulate and understand the molecular bonds that so that things can, as you say, be electrically interesting as well as structurally. And so this is where materials are going in the future. It becomes a very interesting science all of a sudden.
It's not all of a sudden. It's always been interesting. I mean, the final chapter in the book, I try and make this point, which is that the future, I mean, people talk about a lot about nanotechnology and about atoms and this, that and the other, but I don't think the future is actually doing what nature does, which is integrates all these different scales into one coherent object that actually functions at different scales. So it functions in its leaves, let's say a tree, at the atomic scale, breathing carbon dioxide and giving out oxygen. So it's a chemical exchange, and then it creates energy and it moves liquid around. And at different scales, it's got branches and people can climb up them and birds can live in them, the whole ecosystems can be in them. And at the moment, we make materials very monolithically, either at one scale or another scale. You know, in the case of a silicon chip, we can engineer its microscale and its nanoscale, but nothing else about it. And I think when you start having buildings that they're completely integrated at different scales, is when we will really have come of age with our materials knowledge. And we haven't got there yet, but we understand all the different scales individually. And now it's the synthesis moment. So that's what the 21st century is going to be. And it's a big moment for material science. It'll probably be the most important science of the 21st century.
I can't finish this conversation without asking you about what I think from your book sounds like your favorite material. And I'm surprised, given how exciting everything else we've talked about is. I think your favorite material seems to be concrete. And you've got an entire chapter about concrete. But you love it. You absolutely love concrete. Can you give me an elevator pitch?
What's not to love about concrete?
I don't know.
50% of everything that's made is made of concrete. So in a way, we all love concrete. We just don't realize it yet because we're living in a world that's made possible by this stuff. No, we don't all love concrete. You've
got a really lovely description of what concrete is. And I think that for me, that's what's interesting in there is that I didn't know that, despite whatever I've read, how interesting it actually is as a substance and what it is. I mean, take us through it.
So, yeah, well, concrete is essentially powdered rock. We're basically artificial rocks, but you have to powder it up. And then if you just take powdered rock, whatever you like, and then try and reconstitute it, you don't get something that bonds back together again very easily. So you have to you have to take something out. So you have to heat it up to very high temperatures. And then you create this sort of stuff called cement, which will react with water. So when you add water to concrete, it's not like you're just wetting it in order to kind of mix it around. You're creating a chemical reaction, which makes a piece of rock. I mean, A, that's exciting. B, that if you add some stones into that, then you've got this essentially reconstituted mountain, which you can pour anywhere in. So this is, you've completely changed the paradigm of building, where you take some logs or you take some bricks and you build something up. You just make a mold, you pour the stuff in, and hey presto, you want it taller? Just add another story. You just keep going.
And it's wrong to say that concrete dries out. It's not like you put the water in and you wait for the concrete to dry. There's something actually, some bonding and chemical stuff going on there.
Yeah, it's a chemical reaction. And of course, it's a very old material. The Romans invented it, and then it was lost for 1,000 years, which we don't really know why. So it's an intriguing story. And when it was reinvented, it was improved by one critical addition, which is some steel mesh on the inside. And that's the other thing I find amazing, is that the robustness of concrete, the ability to make the whole, you know, the runway of a whole airport or the whole infrastructure in terms of, you know, all the foundations of all the buildings in London essentially are made of concrete, all the cores. That it's so important a material like that is because steel and concrete and cement get on very well together. And you'd never have thought that. That's not predictable. Again, this is a lucky accident. Because when you mix something like a metal with something like a cement or a rock and you heat them up, you expect them to expand at different rates and then crack. But they don't. They have exactly the same thermal expansion coefficient. I got that into the program, thermal expansion coefficient. But and that's a miracle, because without that, the world would be a very different place.
And concrete has an interesting future, would you believe? There are all sorts of self-healing things going on. When I read this about concrete with bacteria in it that can sort of fix itself.
Yeah, self-healing concrete.
Sounds crazy.
It's here today. it is a bizarre story, but I mean, obviously concrete has small cracks in it and you want them to heal. But at the moment, most concrete doesn't have the ability to do that. But if you put this bacteria in, it will stay dormant for 50 years until a small crack basically exposes it to the air, and then the humidity wakes it up and it's hungry, like we all are in the morning. And so it looks around for some food. Now, this concrete has little bits of starch in it, so it starts eating them up and then it excretes poo, but in its case, it's calcite, which is a major constituent of concrete. And that heals the crack. It blocks the crack up, and then it stops eating and goes back into dormancy. Amazing. I mean, what an amazing technology. And not, it's not even science fiction. It's reality.
Are buildings made of this stuff already?
So there's already stuff going into production. The thing is, it's much more expensive than normal concrete. But on the other hand, normal concrete is the cheapest building material on the planet. So the question is, do you want a bridge to last 100 years or 200 years, or do you want it to last 30 years? Now, with these self-healing concretes, you can start thinking about 100, 200-year time spans, and that's much better for the planet, it's much better for economics. But will politicians think like that? That's the question. Will they be willing to pay a little bit more for a longer time span?
One of the problems with concrete, of course, is it's environmentally very unfriendly to make because you have to heat the stuff up quite a lot.
Well, I don't know if I really agree with that. I think because it has a very large CO2, a lot of the CO2 emissions are to do with making concrete.
That's right.
But that's because we make a lot of concrete. So if we didn't make so much concrete, that would decrease. So I think it's partly because we use so much of it that it is such a big component of our emissions.
I suppose my question is, the part of it is the heating up, which you have to do to something like 1500 degrees C of the raw ingredients at the beginning to make cement. And it's kind of an inevitable cost of having societies where you have big buildings, I suppose. You outline the advantages. But are there other types of concrete, futuristic types of concrete? I remember writing about a type of concrete which actually sucks in carbon dioxide as it gets older. I mean, or are there replacements for it? Because we need to deal with climate change in some way. And this is one of the sort of the big wins.
There are definitely technologies that will suck in CO2. But I'm not sure that is the problem anyway. I think the issue for most energy consumption and therefore for global warming, man-made, is energy usage of buildings. And it's not so much the amount of energy made to make the building in the first place. And if you don't keep knocking them down every 20 years because you've got bored of them and you haven't built them properly, then you're doing much better. So I think longer-term planning and much better energy usage within the building will do much more than changing the ingredients of concrete. I'm basically defending them as everyone's saying it's perfectly fine. And actually, you know, what's happening is that people are not thinking about the whole system. When they're just looking at one part of the system and saying that's bad. Well, that's never the answer to any of these problems, in my view. And you certainly shouldn't single out any material as being bad because they're all wonderful.
Well, there's a spirited defence of concrete there. Mark, thank you very much indeed. Mark's going to stay with us to look at some of this week's science news. But if you want to get your hands on a copy of his book, Stuff Matters, it's out now, published by Viking, and it's available in both material and digital form. Find the links on guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now we're turning to our science news section, and along with Mark, I'm joined by The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley. Welcome to the podcast, Sarah.
Hello.
Sarah, let's start with you then. Tell us about this hormone breakthrough that offers safer fertility treatment for people undergoing IVF.
This is a study that's been done as a result of discovery of a hormone called kisspeptin, which is capable of stimulating women's ovaries. That's something that you have to do in IVF. You have to stimulate the ovaries to produce more eggs. But some women react very strongly to the drugs that we use at the moment, and they get something really dangerous in some cases called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. And in 1% of cases of all women who have IVF, that is really nasty, and they end up in hospital for 2 to 6 weeks.
And this is very serious for anyone undergoing this procedure, of course. And this natural protein, kisspeptin, it was research funded by the MRC, not rather than any sort of drug company or anything. I mean, is it completely safe? And how much better is it than the stuff we already know about?
Well, they don't know completely yet. The point of this trial, which was only in 30 women actually, was to try it in women who aren't likely to get ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. These women have got ovaries that they don't have basic polycystic ovary syndrome, which is the condition where you're likely to be overstimulated. So, and the result was that one of these women has actually had a happy, healthy baby boy. So that is a very good news story in that
Absolutely.
Respect.
Absolutely. And so is there any timetable for when this might become available then? I mean, the more tests, I'm assuming, will have to be done before you make this available, but...
Yeah, they need to do a trial now in women who actually are at risk of OHSS, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. And I asked how long it would be until we can use this thing properly, and they said about 2 to 3 years probably, which isn't bad. I think the fact that it is not, that it's funded by the Medical Research Council and the National Institute for Health Research in the UK is fantastic, because it's not a drug company thing at all.
If you think about IVF, I mean, it only came along in the late 70s, of course, and the Nobel Prize, of course, for its invention was only given a few years ago to Robert Edwards. I mean, just to think that it's still risky for women in some respects now. It must have been even worse 30 years ago. Having said that, it's produced thousands of very healthy children. There must be a sort of potential at some point to make it even safer and normal, and you know, there's going to be more need for it probably in the future, isn't there?
Yes, and I think a lot of people have always been a bit worried about the drugs that are used as well. And funnily enough, we're moving towards natural fertility treatments a bit more than we were, so that you can do it in a... There are ways of doing this drug-free, although it doesn't work for everybody, obviously. But yes, we've still got a long way... Well, a little way to go, I would say, yes.
Mark, let's go to the story you brought for us this time, which is about wind farms. This is the fact that the UK's coalition government wants to give residents more say over what kinds of wind farms are built in their area.
Yeah, it seems to be basically a political U-turn. It's basically saying we're a very green government, but if you really don't want your local environment to have a wind farm, we're not going to impose one on you. And I think it's essentially a vote winner, really. It's sort of NIMBYism, which it says, you know, we're going to let the people who kind of don't want to see wind turbines around, we're going to let them have their way. And I think it's very detrimental in so many ways, one of which is just the fact of it, the fact that it's such a blatant use of, you know, planning law to try and win votes, in my view. And secondly, that actually the whole debate around wind farms and about green energy is on the wrong foot, if you ask me. Because basically wind as a power source is very problematic. Because if you can't rely on it. So if the wind doesn't blow, you can't use it. So either as a nation, you have to decide, well, when the wind's not blowing, we're all going to use 10 or 20% less electricity. Or you have to have backup generators, you know, power stations. So for every, you know, wind turbine that goes up there, you have to have backup gas, coal, nuclear.
Are you saying that wind is, there's no point building wind turbines then?
Well, it's a very costly way of basically being greener, because you have to have the amount of capacity the whole nation needs as a backup. And so it's not like you can put a turbine up and that takes out a bit of gas or a bit of coal. It adds a bit of gas and a bit of coal, because you have to have parity. And the only way around this is something called smart grids. So the national, you know, we have a national grid, and that's been very good for us. But now it's completely outdated. In order to efficiently use these variable sources of energy like wind and solar and geothermal and tidal, we have to have a way in which local people can if there's lots of wind, can take advantage of that electricity. And that means that your home needs to be talking locally to the power producers. So there needs to be communication back and forth. That's called a smart grid. And that's what the whole debate should be about. We should be upgrading our whole grid system so that then when you have a local debate about whether there's a wind farm or not, the locals, people around that, will actually be gaining because they'll have a smart grid.
In what way? As in they can sell their electricity?
Yeah, they can get cheap electricity when the wind's blowing. And they can benefit locally to that. So they can, you know, I mean, they're already saying this a little bit in this. The government are actually saying that people can be compensated locally anyway. And there is a bit of that going on. But that's basically giving people money. It's not being smart about this. And if you look 20, 30 years ahead, and in fact the government's own policy is in 2020 to roll out smart grids. But I don't think it's going to happen in that time frame. Here we are in 2013 and no one's really talking about
it. Well, the government's green energy target is 20% renewable electricity by 2020, which is absolutely not going to happen. And I'm no expert in this, but you already can tell that's not going to happen. having said that, I mean, onshore wind seems to be, as you say, a problem. Offshore wind, however, there's plenty of that around. It's more reliable. It's more expensive. Yeah, it's more expensive. But that's just a teething problem. I mean, these things are all brand new technologies. You need to give them some time to bed in. I mean, there is an argument, though, to say that if you live in a nice, quiet bit of the countryside, and in England there's lots of beautiful bits of countryside, would you want your hills blighted by these mammoth windmills? Sarah, would you live near one of these things? Do you mind?
Well, I find them rather attractive, but mainly to drive through.
You're a guardian person, though, you see. You would say that.
But it's, you know, they're absolutely fabulous. Yeah, if you've ever driven down to the south of Spain, for instance, there's fantastic windmills down there. I still call them windmills.
I think they are beautiful, actually.
I agree. And I think another thing that needs to be, people need to actually start generating their own, a little bit of their own electricity, and just see how hard it is. Because actually, you know, we have a glut of electricity coming through, and we're used to it. We live in luxury, and yet it's invisible. So we don't really... there is a lack of connection between what is produced and how it's produced and our consumption of it. And so the moment we finally see one of these turbines, you know, it's such a shock to us. But actually, you know, these things are built all over the place, power stations, nuclear power stations, next to someone, you know, and they have to be next to someone. So, and that local community benefits economically.
Mark, using your skills as a material scientist, what is it that's going to be better than wind in terms of the clean energy that we need? Because it's going to be materials that solve this problem.
Well, yes, I'm glad you said that. So I think the problem is partly the smart grid thing is that we didn't take advantage of variable sources. The other is storage. So wind blows throughout the night when we're not using very much electricity. So if you could store it up and then use it during the day, that would be perfect. But that's not what happens because storing electricity is really difficult. And battery technology, we've seen it with lithium, the wonder material that makes mobile phones so small and laptops so thin. The next big push will be big storage materials for massive amounts of energy. And that, the equivalent of lithium, but I don't even know what it's going to be yet because it's not been discovered yet, would change the whole energy landscape.
And what about photovoltaic cells? I mean, this is another technology that's been around for a long time, but never quite seems to get cheap enough for people to actually...
Well, solar energy is getting cheaper and cheaper. And I do believe that buildings of the future will be made where almost every building is generating electricity, and I think that's only a matter of, you know, a decade or so away. So building
like a terrifying profit from the future, Mark.
No, but it makes total sense. The stuff's raining down from the sky. We should be collecting it, and that's what the trees do. And there are lots of people making artificial leaves, and that's definitely going to happen. But I don't know if there'll be enough energy because we're used to a lot. And we're basically burning up our reserves that were stored millions of years ago, and they're called oil and coal.
Sticking with the environment, the Environment Minister in the British government, Owen Paterson, made a speech last week outlining the government's support for genetically modified crops. This is something that in the UK, GM crops are incredibly political and they're not grown because there's a huge amount of opposition to them still. When they first came along in the early 2000s, many green groups and many newspapers took against them, ripped up crops, and ever since there's been a bit of a backlash against these things. In America, they grow loads of these things, of course, and so far, as far as I know, no reported health problems. In Europe, generally, there seems to be a bit of a problem. Anyway, Owen Paterson says that the UK should become the leader in this technology, and he cites specifically reasons for the fact that climate change is coming, so we need to have technologies which will allow us to grow food in lots of places. It could be as transformative as the original agriculture revolution, he says, and you could grow crops with need for fewer fertilizers and so on. And he says that Europe is going to be left behind otherwise. Now, most governments seem to be pro-GM in this country. The public still needs a lot of convincing. I don't know whether either of you have any thoughts in particular about GM crops. Is this something you'd be happy to, Sarah? I mean, would you be happy for GM crops to be sold in supermarkets and things? Is that something that would worry you?
Personally, it doesn't worry me that much, which is probably a terrible thing for a Guardian writer to say.
No, we're pro-GM here.
I haven't seen any evidence or heard an argument that's yet convinced me that there is a problem with them. And I think you can wait an awful long time to find the evidence you might need. And I accept fully the difficulty that once GM crops mingle with the other crops, then you can't disentangle them again. And so it's a sort of one-way street, isn't it? You can't really row back. The other argument that I find interesting, though, is the whole thing about feeding the world, essentially, the whole nutrition argument. We've recently had a very big nutrition meeting here that David Cameron was pushing at the G8. And the argument there, of course, is that you can use GM crops in Africa and you can feed a lot more people if you do.
And the anti-GM campaigns usually use the arguments such as that these things are unnatural in some way, that we should adopt a precautionary principle. Mark, you know, I don't see you agreeing necessarily with the idea of a precautionary principle, but we do have to be a bit careful, don't we?
I think we have to be careful. That's right. I mean, I would like to see a better discussion, public discussion about it. It seems to be polarized, yes or no, you know. And actually, it's much grayer than that, the benefits and the disadvantages and the philosophical arguments about the precautionary principle. And people get, I think, essentially a bit bored of it all. And I think the way to invoke a better discussion about this is, you know, food labeling, right? So it's fat and sugar and all these sorts of things. I think it should have pesticides on it and it should have, you know, fertilizer on it, right? So this packet of beans had this pesticide and this fertilizer on it and they had this much energy in. Right now, if you compare that to a GM crop, you might suddenly, you know, in the supermarket think, okay, now I can see this. Because people think the vegetables they get are somehow natural and this other one is unnatural, you're not comparing like with like. One is loads of pesticides and loads of fertilizer, and the other one is going to have much less of that, in theory. Let's see if that's true. But I think the discussion has to be brought to everyday buying of food. And that you have to give people information, and I think that the way to do it is through packaging, and that's a material.
I think you get the whole organic argument going on. So people assume if they buy organic, if they're worried about pesticides, they will assume that they're clear of pesticides in their food if they buy organic.
Yes, and they can make that decision too.
Yes.
I suppose you're arguing for choice in that case and transparency.
Yeah.
In the labelling of these things to say, look, here are the benefits that you can get, so up to you which one you decide to go for, and let the market decide?
I don't think it's so bad to let the market decide in this case. I think there'll be a better conversation that's going on around it.
I mean, of course, like I said, the US grows billions of tons of GM maize, which is usually used for animal feed and also for human use as well. And there seems to be no particular backlash over there. Do they have a different they've not got a particularly more enlightened scientific culture than us.
I think they have.
Do you think?
When creationism I lived in America,
and intelligent design?
Okay, I mean, there's not just one America, but when I lived there, my feeling was that there's a sense in which the future is brought to you by technology and that they want to embrace a future. They're very forward-looking people, I think, in general. And I think Britain is backward-looking in general. It sort of feel like we had it better in the past and we'd quite like to return there, please, thank you. It was probably around the 1950s. And, you know, and people go to old churches and old villages and say, oh, this is lovely. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing to say those things, but I do think it's a kind of natural characteristic to look backwards. And therefore, anything that pulls us into the future, everyone's we're getting further from the 1950s.
Well, the 1940s must have been great because they were looking forward to the 1950s. Yeah. All right, we'll leave that there. Just finally, I'd like to end on a bit of a high. Do you both remember Carl Sagan's famous pale blue dot picture, that beautiful picture from Voyager 1 taken in 1990, a sunbeam and then a little dot in the middle, which was Earth, taken by Voyager quite far off into the outer reaches of the solar system. And he wrote this beautiful sort of prose poem, essentially, about how all of the humans that have ever existed have lived in this tiny pixel and that all the loves, all the wars, everything are in there. Anyway, a repeat of that will be happening on July the 19th, 10:30 a.m. British summer time. Other time zones are available. The Cassini spacecraft, which is currently orbiting Saturn, 1.44 billion miles away from Earth, is going to turn and take a picture of Earth. It's already taken pictures of Earth before, but this never in the visible spectrum. So NASA wants you both and all of us to wave to Cassini at 10:30 on July the 19th.
In the visible spectrum.
In the visible spectrum. Yeah. Don't do anything in infrared or anything. It's not going to capture it. Unfortunately, it's going to be North America that faces Cassini. So we'll have to look through the Earth somehow if you want to really see it. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a nice touch.
It's really nice. It's,
you've got to do it, right?
Yeah.
And since we're here, we were talking about space, why don't I just ask you, if you were given an opportunity to go to Mars, for example, using your materials, Mark, you know.
Well, that's what you need.
Yeah, you'd need materials, I'm sure.
Well, the cosmic ray is a big problem, actually.
Yes or no, would you go?
I'd definitely go.
You go?
Never in a million years.
No?
No.
Sarah?
No, desperately, definitely not.
But you, oh, okay.
This Fair planet's enough. Quite good enough for me, thanks.
Sarah, Mark, thank you both very much indeed. For all these stories and more, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. So Sarah, another notable story in the past week was the publication of a report on domestic violence against women. You met the team behind the report, one of whom was Professor Charlotte Watts, who we've spoken to on the podcast before. She's from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, a mathematician by training, but she's really brought the analysis and collection of massive data sets into essentially public health and the sort of policy decision making that the World Health Organization makes. I mean, very, very robust methods now. Just tell us a bit more about the report and the people you spoke to.
I spoke to Charlotte and also to Dr. Claudia Garcia Moreno from the World Health Organization. So they're the joint authors of the report. And they've spent some years, in fact, looking at gender and violence and its relationship to health. Because it's interesting that this report actually focuses on what healthcare workers can do, because they are the first point of contact with most women who suffer violence. But I think what most people would find looking at this report is the sheer shocking and distressing level of the violence that's out there. There's far more than most of us would realise.
So I'm Claudia Garcia Moreno and I work at the World Health Organization.
And I'm Charlotte Watts and I'm a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
So we're talking about violence against women, particularly intimate partner violence. Maybe you could tell me, Charlotte, what we know about the levels of violence against women.
So what we've done in this report that we're launching today is for the first time systematically compiled data from all around the world on the levels of violence that women experience. And what we find is that 35% of women globally will experience partner violence or sexual violence from someone other than their partner.
That's quite shockingly high. Did you find there were regional differences?
There was some regional variations, but everywhere around the world, the levels of violence were unacceptably high. And so what the main message from the report is that this is a global phenomena and we really need to take this issue seriously.
So the World Health Organization report that you two have authored is looking, isn't it, at part of it's looking at what healthcare professionals can do. Why did you take that approach?
Well, there are two reports that we are releasing today. The first one looks at the size of the problem, as has been described by Charlotte, but it also looks at what are the health effects of these violence. And it really shows the overwhelming toll that these forms of violence have on the health of women. For example, 42% of women who are exposed to partner violence report having an injury from this violence. These women are twice as likely to be depressed or to have problems with alcohol use compared to women who have not been exposed to violence. They are twice as likely to have an abortion, 1.5 times more likely to have a sexually transmitted infection, and in some regions to be exposed to HIV. The report also documents the rates of homicide, and what it finds is that of women who are murdered, 38% have been murdered by an intimate partner. So we see that this is a really big contributor to women's ill health. And in response to that, one of the many things that needs to happen is that the health sector needs to be better positioned to respond to the issue. The health response is also often an entry point to other services, so health providers need to be aware of what possibilities there are to refer women. So the health sector itself, by itself, is not going to resolve the problem. We are very aware that the health sector is only one of the players, but they can play an important role in early identification, in mitigating consequences, in supporting children from violence, and also supporting a science-based approach to prevention. And this is the other area where WHO is very interested in promoting, you know, how do we stop this violence from happening in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Charlotte, have looked at the prevention of violence, haven't you?
Yeah.
This is really quite a huge topic, and you talked about social norms earlier, for instance. How do you change whole cultures where women are undervalued?
I mean, I you know, when you look at the figures of 35%, clearly the health sector has a really important role to play, but we really fundamentally have to be thinking about prevention. And there's a range of different approaches that people are trying to use in different countries to shift the acceptability of violence, to challenge established norms, as well as empower women and address issues such as childhood exposures to violence. What we've been doing in our work is trying to find out, well, what kinds of interventions seem promising and what might be things that could be replicated in other settings. And so, for example, in rural South Africa, we did an intervention to empower women economically and socially and showed that we halved the levels of violence over 2 years.
So it makes a difference, does it, whether women have a job, for instance, or they're better educated?
On a large scale, we see those sorts of factors as being very important. But I think alongside that, we have to engage with challenging norms around the acceptability of violence to try and think about how do we promote different dynamics within relationships. So things like improved communication, for example, joint discussions and decision-making, because it's those sorts of things that seem to be effective in terms of reducing the levels of violence that happen.
I can see this working on a sort of individual level where you've got a family, a couple who are going through terrible times or whatever, but the man is certainly violent towards the woman. But how do you do these things on a national scale?
I mean, we're still learning about how to do things at a national scale. At one level, I think attitudes towards and expectations about women's roles in society are changing rapidly. You know, if you think about the UK, you know, what might be expected in my mother's generation or my grandmother's generation is incredibly different to, you know, what we expect now. So at one level, we're in a time of change. And I think that we need to kind of catalyze on that change and think about how can we make sure that that issues around equality between men and women are center of that change. At another level, I think we have really important entry points. So, for example, schools. What are we teaching our kids about expectations in relationships? Are we talking about issues such as consent, respect, inappropriateness of coercion? These are the kind of issues that we really need to be tackling head on and discussing, because I think it's that sort of change that can really impact on the levels of violence that we're recording.
Do you need political leadership in a country to address this as well? Because you're looking at the health workers, you know, how women end up in hospital or go to their doctor and you know, have broken limbs or whatever. But so that will maybe get the involvement of the Ministry of Health through the sorts of reports that WHO is producing here. But don't you need greater political leadership than that?
I mean, of course, we need political leadership on this issue. I mean, I think we are seeing progress. I think on the global level, lots of countries have laws that explicitly make domestic violence illegal. So that sends out a very strong message that this isn't okay. But we need leadership in terms of committing resources to really tackling this issue head on. Mm. And I think that's where the challenge lies, is actually the leadership to actually really put money behind the many commitments that different governments have made and really sort of say, how do we translate those commitments into actual action?
I think all leaders have a responsibility to take this issue seriously, and that these numbers that are in this report really are a wake-up call to all of us, and particularly leaders, be they political leaders, business leaders, religious leaders, to take action and not just be passive bystanders, but speak out on the issue, allocate the necessary resources, and really put this issue central in the health, development, justice, and other agendas.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
For more information on the World Health Organization report and a link to Sarah's article, go to the podcast blog guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's all we have for this week. Thanks to our guests and to you, dear listeners, for lending us your cochlear. But for now, from me, Alok Jha, and producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.